following program was originally broadcast at noon on February 25th in the studios of Radio Free Palmer. Melissa Benke and Lauren Getty King joined moderator Judy Getty in discussing the clothes women wear. Enjoy.
Before we get started, I want to remind our listeners that you may call in during the live broadcast at noon on February 25th and share your thoughts with us. The number is 745-8900. Today we're going to talk about the clothes we wear and changes in cultural practice. Is this something that either one of you spend any time thinking about?
Absolutely not until more recently, I will say. As I'm only 21, I am still kind of coming off of that teenage high where you discover you're making money and you get to go out and buy the pretty things that you want. So it definitely is kind of a newer, more widely talked about thing here, and I think that coming into that realization of thinking about your clothing and how you purchase it and how it differs from everything that's been done before and in the past is quite new to me.
And even though I'm not 21,
a little bit older than that,
I sort of feel the same way. It's been a gradual awareness for me, just becoming more aware of issues that are discussed in this book.
And just thinking about my own style, I had always thought of just as clothing as something that would portray my personality, but not necessarily something I wanted to spend a lot of money on.
Right.
So we'll be talking today about, you know, how people have changed their attitudes about how much they want and how little they want to spend. And that's certainly something Klein brings up frequently. So, when you look back, Melissa, do you think that you've changed how you approach buying clothes then and what you choose to wear?
Sure. You know, I lived in Boston for over a decade as a young adult. So when I was there, I shopped in larger, fancier stores. I shopped their sales because I couldn't afford, you know, off-the-rack prices. Now I shop thrift stores and secondhand stores.
Mm-hmm.
Not that I couldn't shop other places, but it's what I find enjoyable, really.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we call that treasure hunting because you just never know what you're going to find.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, Lauren, as my daughter, you certainly have had to experience the rants that I go on at home about clothing. Mm-hmm. So I think all of my daughters were raised appreciating that you can go into a thrift store and it's okay to wear secondhand clothing, mm-hmm. whereas other people might not appreciate that. And, you know, when you talk about living in a urban area like Boston, and so part of the conversation we're going to have today, I think, is going to be that Alaska may not follow all of these trends or these rules. And so that gives it a kind of an interesting spin, too. So just kind of historically, if we think about clothing in America, I'm reading another book, history, women's history, and we have to remember that when Americans first came to this country, we brought textiles from England. And then, of course, even as we were growing, our textiles came from England. And it wasn't until the Revolution, when people boycotted British products, that American women started making their own fabrics, their own textiles. And then, of course, along the eastern seaboard, where the mills were built and people really developed this as a way to manufacture and industrialize those areas of the country. What Klein gets into then is just thinking about what did we spend before on clothing. And I thought it was interesting, in 1901, an average American family had an income of $750, and they spent 14% of that, or $108 a year, on clothing.
And I noted in the book, and another place she mentioned, in 2009, less than 3% of our annual household budget was spent on clothes.
Right. And you know, so even though we're spending a lower percentage, we almost have this expectation that clothing needs to be cheap,
mm-hmm.
that we need to be able to buy lots of it, and it should be very inexpensive. So, you know, maybe not everybody, but certainly the majority that she's talking about. The other interesting comparison I thought was, and I think about this, that in 1906, a ready-to-wear suit at a bargain basement was $8. But today, that's $200. that's a lot of money.
Mm-hmm. Right. And today people, if they have $200 to spend on clothes, they want to buy a bunch of different things instead of buying one quality piece.
Right. I was telling my daughters the story about when I was, I think probably 21, 22, and I was a new mother, and I had been in Sears shopping, and there was a powder blue pantsuit in there. So this is like late 70s, just so you know. And the fabric was wonderful. It kind of had that sateen, and it fit me, and I just fell in love with this jacket and pantsuit, and I wanted it. It was $29. And what I had to do was go get a job, a part-time job as a waitress, so that I could, you know, put it on layaway and make some payments on it so I could finally own it outright. And I haven't looked what $29 in today's dollars would be, but, you know, it was that kind of effort where it was a big deal. And so I was asking my daughters, do people still do layaway? I mean, is there even a need for layaway?
They do. It exists. I've never personally done it, but I would imagine that having to, you know, go through that just for something you really want or need would create almost a relationship you have with this item of clothing, and it would be, you would earn it. It's worth it. And it places more value on the item of clothing automatically.
Right. Yeah, and that is the relationship I think people mm-hmm. had with their clothing before.
Mm-hmm.
It was personal.
Mm-hmm.
So after World War I, prices of dresses came down to about $16.95, or less than $200 today. Annual expenses were $238, or 17% of annual income. So again, clothing was a huge investment, and there was value to it. Then we go into the Great Depression, where you just didn't throw anything away, and my parents sort of lived that way. Certainly my grandmother did. I don't know, your mother probably practiced that.
Definitely.
Saved everything.
Definitely, right. That was, you know, something that I grew up with, especially growing up here. You know, it was a work to go off to go shopping. You know, to drive to Anchorage was difficult, and so we shopped through catalogs, and you just learned to use what you had. You took care of what you had.
Mm-hmm. So what catalogs did you shop from?
Sears and JCPenney's and Ward's.
Yes. We also had Alden's catalog. I don't remember Alden's.
Oh, yes, I do remember Alden's.
Okay. And so when it was time for school to start, that was the other big thing then. Get out the catalogs. You were allowed to pick out two new dresses and purchase those two new dresses for school. And that was so exciting when those two dresses would come.
Exactly. When the catalog would first arrive in the mail.
Yes.
So exciting.
Yes. Very different feel to it. The other part of this then, because we were talking about how it's changed, that we expect more but pay less. And because now we've accumulated so many things, and Klein talked about counting her items of clothing. Do you remember how much she said she had?
It was a lot.
It was almost 400.
It was, yeah.
And I think she said she didn't count things like scarves or belts
or underwear.
Yeah.
Socks, yeah.
So she had an incredible amount of clothing. And so along with that, I thought it was kind of interesting if you think about this then, that the sizes of our homes have changed. So in the 1950s, an average home was 983 square feet. And in 2004, it was 2,349 square feet. And you think about how much storage space we need to have, the walk-in closets, all the items that are sold to us to store all the clothing and that we buy, including those vacuum sealers so we can scrunch down our clothing mm-hmm. and make them take up less space.
When you have more than you need more space.
Right.
Well, along with, you know, I talked a little bit about that America was doing their own textiles, and we were creating our own clothing, and, you know, it's kind of a fascinating history about, you know, the sweatshops and women fighting for labor rights and all of that during that early 1900s, too. And what happened, though, was in the 1990s, we started losing our manufacturing jobs, our apparel manufacturing jobs, and a lot of them were being sent overseas. And in a 10-year period from 1997 to 2007, we lost 650,000 jobs that were in the apparel industry. So this has huge ramifications, I think, in many parts of our country.
Mm-hmm.
Before we even sent jobs overseas, the other thing that Klein talks about is that the manufacturers were chasing lower wages, and they went to the South as early as the 1930s and 40s. And at that time, less than 5% of our clothing was sold in the U.S. was imports, and that was 1965. So there are a few places today in the United States that are manufacturing clothes. And she quotes some of the labor rates, which a sewing machine operator makes about $9 an hour in the United States, which is, you know, just a little bit above minimum wage. But then she talks quite a bit about some of the wages in the other countries. I don't know if one of you want to comment on that.
Mm-hmm. I suppose when I was reading this part, it seems like, I mean, it first occurred to me that this is a smart business move. I mean, you get the same labor force for so much cheaper, and obviously, so you get to go to places in Latin America, in Asia, and I guess looking at it from that viewpoint, that's just an obvious move on their part. It's more interesting as a consumer to look at your tags and see where things are made and just notice the sheer amount of stuff that's made in very specific parts of the world. But then when you think about it a little further and you're thinking about how much these people are making specifically and she lays it out for you, I mean, just on a global scale, it's quite shocking.
So she does indicate that in the Dominican Republic, it's about $150 a month. In China, it's $117 to $147 a month. And then most appalling of all is Bangladesh, which is $43 a month. And I can remember reading that, you know, for quite some time, I've been opposed to buying things made in China, and which makes it very difficult to buy things because so much is produced in China. And then I had read that as China is increasing their wages for their laborers, it was driving some of the business into even poorer countries. And Bangladesh and Vietnam were a couple of those. And so, you know, from my point of view, here I was avoiding buying things made in China. And I thought, oh, well, now it's made in Bangladesh. So, I mean, you really have to kind of pay attention to, well, why is it being moved to Bangladesh? Mm-hmm. For one reason only, they can get cheaper labor costs.
And how they started producing goods, and instead of writing made in China, they write made in and then a specific province in China or whatever to, you know, just to avoid saying made in China, which is so frequent.
If you're avoiding that. Mm-hmm. Go ahead, Melissa.
Right. I really did appreciate this book. I appreciated the research I think she must have put in, because as you mentioned, for years I've had this sort of vague sense, a vague realization of what was going on, that it wasn't a good thing that so many of the clothes are made overseas. But this really, she really packs a lot of information, a lot of facts into this book.
Right. And I think as a, just discussing how she wrote the book, I didn't think it was very well organized, but it does have a lot of information. Mm-hmm. So when I was kind of sorting through and thinking about how we were going to talk about it, it took a few minutes how to piece that together. So I want to remind our listeners that you're listening to Radio Book Club on 89.5. Please call us at 745-8900 if you want to share your thoughts. We're talking about the book Overdressed by Elizabeth Klein. I think one of the other things in looking at our culture and shopping that we're talking about is, and you know, Melissa and I, we mentioned the catalogs. You'd get a fall-winter catalog and then you'd get a spring-summer catalog. Or you'd go in the stores and they'd brought out the fall winter clothing or the spring summer clothing. So you knew, you know, this is what's in style for this season. And now that is changing.
Right. They call it fast fashion. And they're just bringing in new styles all the time. Every 2 weeks, I think she said. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's every store or whatever, every area, but that just blew me away, every 2 weeks.
Right. So there doesn't seem to be a lot of the planning that goes into it. It's just they're telling us what we're going to wear, and it comes in that quickly. Those changes are made. Plus, then, if I bought something and 2 weeks later now there's something new out, that's supposed to bring me into the store and make me want to have that new thing too.
Right. And that's part of why you don't want to spend a lot of money. You want to buy something cheap and be able to buy just all the time.
Mm-hmm. And replace it easily, yes. I think just another part of this is shoes and how we think about shoes. I can remember going to the shoe repair, you know, to have soles replaced or to have heels replaced or stitching redone. And Klein does talk a little bit about that you know, all but 15% of our shoes now are made in China. It doesn't mean that, you know, that means that they're made in the United States. We import shoes from many places.
I think it was less than 2% of our shoes are made in the U.S.
So I think, Lauren, you had some other information that you looked at about that? Or
I did, and it's kind of fascinating to see just even the different classifications of shoes, because if you look at some, if you're looking for, say, like a sports shoe, a training shoe, just the how few options there were for things made either in the U.S. or even just outside of China. And there were a couple brands, you know, that make things in the U.S. I think, I don't want to say too many brand names, but, but you know, it was kind of, it made a statement that there are so few outlets and so few options, even online, which is seemingly endless, for shoes made here.
And I think that, you know, that reminds me of the other piece, that sometimes we'll see a product that says made in the USA, and then you have to look a little further because it'll say of imported materials.
Mm-hmm.
Or I think one of the things that you were talking about with the shoes is that they may be partially assembled in the U.S., mm-hmm. but...
Right, and certain companies, well, all companies, I think, are allowed to say made in the USA if a certain percentage of it was assembled in the U.S. And I think it's only like 60% of the shoe has to be assembled in the U.S. or something. And that's pretty small, so...
Okay.
Yeah.
I don't know that I've ever looked to see where my shoes were made particularly, but I've always been willing to pay more for good shoes. Mm-hmm. And I think it's because, I mean, I want them to be comfortable. That just seems such an important part
yes.
of your day, whether your feet are comfortable. So it is hard for me to imagine people just buying really cheap, flimsy shoes because I don't think of them as being, you know, how can they be comfortable?
And I don't know if you've ever heard a woman say this, that, oh, they're horrible. They're, you know, they're uncomfortable, they're tight, but they look good. Yeah. So, you know, again, that's part of the cost of fashion is, mm-hmm. You know, sacrificing comfort for looks.
And even health.
Yes.
The health of your feet. Mm-hmm. You
yeah.
know?
Or other things. You can fall over in those shoes, I think. Klein does talk about textiles, and again, this was, I have to admit, something that I hadn't given a lot of thought to, that, you know, as I've been paying attention to where does my clothing come from, I haven't really thought about what is it made out of, where did that come from, and what does it take to make the textiles or the fabrics. Kind of interesting, again, you know, I had heard of the International Ladies Garment Workers Union, and I can remember those commercials on TV, look for the label, and I would be always so proud if I had clothing that had the ILGWU label in it. So she talks a little bit about the production of these man-made fibers has doubled over the past 15 years, and polyester is most of that. Now, polyester, in my mind, always had a bad name. That was sort of like what old people wore. I don't know if you...
Mm-hmm. Polyester pantsuit.
Yeah, yes.
Right?
Yes. But that seems to be what a lot of our clothing is made out of now. And then this other product called viscose, which gives clothing a wool-like feel, which, again, I hadn't paid a lot of attention to.
Mm-hmm. And going back to polyester, isn't it made out of plastic?
Like a plastic, yeah.
Yes, and Klein talks about that. Mm-hmm. And so as a resource, it's just, you know, it's not very earth-friendly.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And thinking along this line back to... using viscose as a substitution for wool, you know, that gave me pause. You think you'd want to go out and find wool products then, you know, it being a better fabric overall. But then I was doing some research and even buying real wool, depending on where you get it or where it's sourced, can be harmful to animals depending on where it came from. So, you know, there's just, you think you found a nice solution or a nice go around, and looking into other materials and such, they just have sort of different downsides. So one example I found was some companies use wool, but through a technique called mulesing, I think. And so that means that they, it says it's where farmers carve large strips of skin and flesh off the backs of unanesthetized lambs, legs, and tails to prevent fly strike. So PETA has a long-running campaign against this and urges consumers and companies to boycott merino wool in particular. And so, you know, you think of workers and you think of sweatshops, but then animal cruelty is a whole other ballgame here, so.
Oh, Lauren, yeah. You just opened up a hole.
Melissa looked really upset when Lauren had to give that whole spiel, because it's like, now what do I have to give up? Well, right. Do you feel that when you buy at thrift stores that you circumvent those problems?
Oh, that's a really good question, Judy. I don't know. I go back and forth on that. I think so. Okay, well, it's not thrift stores, but I think this relates to it. I have a fur coat in my closet because it was purchased by my uncle, who was a bush pilot. He bought it years ago for my mother, so I have it now. I would never go out and buy a fur coat, but I have it, so I wear it. Same thing for me. Those items have already been made, so if I find them in the thrift store, I usually will go ahead and wear them, buy it and wear it. Mm-hmm. How about you?
Well, back to my made in China rule. If it's in a thrift store, I would exempt myself from the rule. So, you know, it's like, oh, it's already been purchased once. Now the money is going to the thrift store. And so now it doesn't seem, I don't know, as bad. You know, maybe it's rationalization. But, you know, the point Lauren is making, when we dig into this stuff and we start to think about, is it ethically produced in so many different ways, the treatment of animals, the treatment of the workers, the textiles that are involved, and are they earth-friendly? Yeah, so it becomes mind-boggling.
It's very complicated.
I'm only going to wear what I have and nothing else, yes. The thing with the fabrics, and I think I've noticed this, you know, I have younger daughters, and when they bring home stuff from certain stores that cater to the younger people, so it's the very inexpensive clothing, It feels so thin, and you think, how long is this going to last? A couple of washings, and it seems like it'll be, gone. And so she talks about how, you know, just to shave costs, they'll take something that was once a 6-ounce shirt and reduce it to 5 ounces. And she even suggests, you know, find some clothes made before 1990 and feel those and compare it to some of the newer stuff.
But I think it goes along with the style, too. You know, oh, this is so light and flowy and dainty and feminine. You'll feel like you're wearing nothing. It seems like an upside, if anything, to the way that they sell these clothes to younger generations, especially of young girls.
Yes. You can spin anything. So in 1950, we produced 10 million tons of fiber worldwide. Now we're up to 70 million tons of fiber. And when you think about the natural resources that go into that, it takes 145 million tons of coal and between 1.5 and 2 trillion gallons of water. So again, just thinking about, you know, the incredible impact it has on the earth. And when we look at some of these countries overseas that don't have regulations, she talks about this Pearl River in Guangdong in China, where the wastewater is not treated. And because of the manufacturing they were doing, the river would actually run red or indigo. And then, of course, you know, the bad air quality is also pretty well known in parts of China. So, Melissa, you brought up what Klein calls fast fashion. And I liked this quote that fashion largely deserves its bad reputation. It's now a powerful $1 trillion industry that has too much influence over our pocketbooks, self-image, and storage spaces. It behaves with embarrassing little regard for the environment or human rights.
That sums it up pretty well.
Much of what we've been talking about, huh? So I think that one of the other things, Lauren, you looked at was what Klein calls the haulers, and that's H-A-U-L-E-R-S. And you want to talk about that, what that looked like?
Yeah, so I actually hadn't even heard of them before being introduced to this book. But haulers are usually young women, but they go out and shop wherever it may be, a specific store or multiple stores, and come back and make videos of their haul, of what they've purchased, and basically make a video. Most of them go on YouTube, I think, but all they really do is hold up everything they bought and say why they bought it, why it's so attractive, what they love about it. And it's interesting to watch because there'll be 15-minute videos of them just pulling things out of their bags, and it's like the Mary Poppins bag. It's seemingly never endless sometimes. But and then the other piece to this is that if they get so many views, if they're becoming more and more popular on YouTube, companies and brand names will actually seek them out, send them things to include in their videos, because it's like additional advertising for them, really, because they have such an influence on what their viewers are going to go out and buy.
Incredible.
So, it is.
Yes. And, when Klein's talking about the impact that these stores have on our purchasing decisions, and then like the haulers too, but I think about, the fashion industry has always had this incredible influence on what women wear. And, we mentioned shoes as far as discomfort. But again, historically, if you think about corsets or getting laced up into things so that your waist was 20 inches, and the hoop skirts, and just ridiculous things that women have put on in the name of fashion.
Right.
And now, that's being driven by stores like Target and Old Navy. So, telling us what's in and what we should wear. So kind of speaking of designers, though, this is an area that Klein talks about as really hurting the professional people who do clothing design. That as prices have been driven down, you would have thought that designer clothing would have also been driven down, but prices for designer clothing has been driven up. And I thought that spoke to the clear divide then of the haves and the have-nots. So the majority of the people are buying the cheaper goods, and then the 1% are buying those very expensive designer clothes.
Mm-hmm. I did find it interesting, as she mentioned at one point, that some of the well-known designer names aren't necessarily the really quality product any longer. And I have found an example of that. My mother-in-law died not too long ago, and I inherited some of her clothing. She had some very nice things, some with still tags on, and I pulled out a blouse the other day and wore it and discovered, it certainly wasn't shoddy. It was lovely material, but I was surprised at some of the stitching. It was just a little bit loose, and so even some of those really well-known names, the quality just isn't quite the same.
We're going to keep talking about that, but first we're going to take a quick break for a station identification.
You're listening to KVRF FM, Radio Free Palmer. Our program schedule and playlists are available online at radiofreepalmer.org. Big Cabbage Radio.
The Radio Book Club is supported by the Read Alaska Award Program at Fireside Bookstore in downtown Palmer.
So we were talking about fashion designers as Elizabeth Klein talks about them in the book Overdressed. And one of the things I found interesting and just kind of observing it in the, in the world of clothing was how some stores like Target now are using designers, and I'll say Missoni, I don't know if that's correct or not, but a designer who made a line of clothing to sell in Target, and apparently it was received very well. Did you follow that story at all?
Mm-mm.
Okay. Supposedly, it sold out incredibly fast. And, you know, here's a high-profile designer who, you know, is selling clothing through Target. So it's sort of, again, a way for the masses to get a name brand clothing. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, your comment about even looking at some things that are name brand or designer brand, and they just don't have the quality anymore. Mm-hmm. But I think they're willing to sacrifice that because it'll sell and it gets their name out there.
Right. I didn't mark it down, but someplace in here, Klein talks about how some of the designers really see the clothing almost as a lost leader. They're gaining a lot of their profits by through handbags, belts, scarves, accessories. And I thought that was interesting.
Mm-hmm.
You know, again, just kind of that almost that throwaway culture.
And the other thing in the United States, apparently designers cannot copyright their items. In other countries, there's more stringent laws about that. And so if somebody takes a skirt or a blouse or whatever and takes it over to China and visits numerous factories, which is one thing that Klein even did, just pretending to be a manufacturer or a clothes dealer, that she wants something made, they can look at the item and copy it. And, I mean, I'm no seamstress, but I would imagine that, I mean, you can deconstruct something pretty easily and decide what would go into copying it.
Right.
Making the pattern.
And I was thinking here that that's sort of a godsend for young women who don't want to spend as much money, and they see, you know, you can achieve like this runway look or this great design, but you can purchase it at a local store, or you can, you know, find a duplicate of it anywhere online. It sort of makes you feel like you have access to something that would otherwise be out of your reach. So it seems like a positive thing to people in our generation.
To young consumers? Yeah, I can see that.
Yeah.
Yes. That if you can't afford the $500 name recognition bag, that you can buy the knockoff.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Exactly.
And she does talk a little bit about some of those young women, though, that are so driven by having some real brand name or designer name things that they get into incredible debt. And, you know, see, I don't even know enough about designer names to, you know, some of the things, I don't know if you can say some of the...
Again, we're in Alaska. I don't wear designer clothing. Even if I could afford it, it isn't widely available here, I don't believe. But,
to go into Nordstrom's or something, huh?
Mm-hmm.
But, okay, Louis Vuitton, that kind of thing, where these young women are buying $800 handbags or, you know, $500 shoes. And she talks about how the women who were in the Sex and the City, and because that was what they wore, and the one character, that was the kind of things that she would purchase, that, you know, they just want to mimic that.
I mean, maybe this is just judgmental, but when I watched that show, even though they're in, like, New York, a fashion, one of the fashion capitals, you know, I just think they look ridiculous because they look out of place. You know, I'm not going to wear a giant tutu to my job, even if I was a famous writer. I just don't understand the practicality of it.
It's out of place even in New York City, or it would be out of place because you live in Alaska, or it's out of place anywhere.
Yeah. As an Alaskan girl, I suppose it's out of place for me in every regard, but but even in that context, even within the show, maybe it's just me, but I thought, you know, comparing them to the way people are dressed in the background, even behind them, it's different. There's a divide there as well.
And again, is it fashion dictating to us? And maybe not us, because we're Alaskans. But now we're going to just totally distance
Carhartt
ourselves.
Carhartt is our brand name.
Yeah. Bunny boots.
Yeah. No wonder we're getting more and more puzzled as we have this conversation. People spend what? But I think even just going into Anchorage, and when I talk in my psychology class about status and what that means and how we gauge the status of people, one of the ways we gauge status is what are people wearing. And we talk about in Alaska that, especially out in the valley, that there's not a lot to gauge. We're pretty similar in what we wear, and, you know, but go into Anchorage and you just get a little bit different kind of slice of life, especially if you go downtown Anchorage during a work day and you see people walking around, especially in the summertime when you can see what they're wearing. But, you know, people dress differently, even in Anchorage.
And not only are there more people there to observe, but just the greater number of stores and what they buy there that we don't have available to us, 45 miles away.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We have to drive in for it, huh? Mm-hmm. So, Klein, you know, because she was a person who would always try to find deals, and I think that, you know, she tries to find deals, whether it's, you know, some of the name brand or designer brand things that we've been talking about. So she disconnects herself from, you know, all those other persons too, who pay those exorbitant prices. And, you know, I think, you know, again, I think that's the difference between the have and have nots. I think if you've got plenty of money, you don't have any problem paying those high prices for something, even though, you know, there's been an increase there. And have nots are going to think, well, I really scored if I got some, you know, Jimmy Choo shoes or whatever they are at half price. If they even do that, I don't know. But what I was saying about these young women that, you know, get so enthralled with having designer name things and they buy these things, this one woman in the book that Klein interviewed ended up having to sell her things on eBay because she'd gotten into so much trouble with her credit card and couldn't afford to live that lifestyle anymore. So, were you going to say something? Oh, the other thing that I thought was interesting, too, was when in the manufacture of clothing that embellishments are used to make an item look more expensive.
Yes, that was interesting, how just clipping on, just adding fancy zippers and bows and even doing it to hide the poor quality stitching or whatever.
Right. And so sometimes, haven't you looked at some of the clothing and I'm thinking, you know, some of this cheaper fashion stuff and think, why do they have that ridiculous flower on there? Or, you know, just something. And then you think now, oh, you know, it's to make it look, ooh, look at the thought that went into this. You know, it's got a floppy flower on it and mm-hmm. some extra buttons or something. And I think Klein talks about how she looks how something's attached. And sometimes the stuff is like glued on or.
Right. Yeah. Right. I liked her comment in the book someplace where she said, well, they were just talking about how, you know, in years past, the quality was so much better. My dolls wore clothes that were better made than today's clothing.
Oh. That brings it all home, doesn't mm-hmm. it? And you almost think that this is one of those consumer-savvy classes people need, because I'm not a person who sews, and if I look at things, I'm not going to necessarily know that it's well-made or not. Probably.
Right. I wrote that as well, that I'm sort of blissfully ignorant when it comes to, even if I'm looking at the tag or paying attention to what fabrics were used in the making, I'm not going to, you know, I'm none the wiser because I don't know that elastane is, or whatever it is bad or good or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Some things are glaring, though. I mean, if seams are crooked or...
Sure.
Yeah.
Right. And she was talking about how so many of the clothes made with the cheap fabrics and poorly constructed literally fall apart after a few washes. Mm-hmm. And I can't say that I don't recall many clothes of mine doing that, you know. I don't sew either. I grew up having handmade clothes. My mother sewed many of my clothes when I was in grade school, even my first prom dress she made for me. So I think maybe some of it I learned by osmosis or something, but like the clothes I picked out this morning, a shirt and sort of sweater jacket, texture, the feel of clothes it means a lot to me. And I, you know, and it just sort of by luck, I happened to pull out two things. I looked at see where they were made, and they were both made in the USA. But so it's just sort of like, I mean, I buy things that often just by the feel of them. They're soft, they're just nice quality feel.
And before we went on the air, our very kind assistant here, Mike, was telling us about the practice of, in order to get rid of things, that you touch them and decide if they make you happy. Mm-hmm. And if not, that is something you can get rid of.
Does mm-hmm. this fill the void in my heart?
Wow, that's a high standard. So many things around the house you could get rid of then.
But I mean, even that, people, you know, on television, in our culture, et cetera, use shopping as a coping mechanism. I had a really bad day. I'm just going to go shopping. It's almost an activity for that. And, you know, this high level of consumerism trying to replace something. And that is even more of a reflection on who's doing the shopping.
Right. Yeah. It is entertaining.
But she described it that it used to be leisurely. Mm-hmm. And then she talks about people who will run out at their lunch break or after work. And so it's almost a daily or twice daily activity. So where do you put yourself in that? That it's leisurely and enjoyable or more towards the regular basis?
Somewhere in the middle. I know I have days where I think, oh, I have sort of a free day and I want to do something for myself. And I might go shopping. But my favorite secondhand clothes store is small, and that's why it's my favorite. It's not overwhelming. I go in, there's a small room of women's clothes. I can see everything that's there probably in 20 minutes. Uh-huh. And they'll be a dollar rack sometimes, and I might see something on the dollar rack and think, okay, well, even if this doesn't fit, if this doesn't work for me, I've only spent a dollar. It's less than a cup of coffee. She talks about that in the book.
Oh, right. Yeah. And not necessarily used clothing, but
right.
new clothing. But even, I mean, because it's ridiculous prices, $3 mm-hmm. or $5. Mm-hmm. And how, if it's $3 and it comes in pink, well, I may as well get the blue and the purple and the tan and the orange one, too.
Mm-hmm. Crazy.
Yeah. Very thoughtful. But since you brought up the thrift store, so let's talk a little bit about just, you know, and I think that this was interesting part of the book, too, because it's like, what happens to our clothing when we're done with it? So this idea that there's this immense consumerism and people are buying more than they need, with oftentimes the thinking that, well, if I don't like it or, you know, it didn't fit, I'll just bundle it up and I'll take it to the thrift store. And I have to admit, I'm guilty of some of this thinking that there's some poor person out there that's going to really want my old stuff.
Yep, I used to think that, yes. Not after reading this.
Okay. So she visits one particular Salvation Army distribution center, and this is one that serves 8 stores in Queens and Brooklyn. And so, again, you have to think of this magnified all across the United States, times however many different distribution centers in different thrift stores other than Salvation Army. So they process an average of 5 tons of outcast clothing every single day.
It's mind-boggling.
It is. This isn't like it takes them a month or a year to collect. It's every day. That's what's donated. And so out of that, 11,200 garments are chosen. I don't know if there's some kind of numbering system, but this is what Klein says. And that's about 20% of what's given to thrift stores will actually get sold there.
And then bundled up in these bales, leftover clothing, sent to Africa.
Mm-hmm.
And even in Africa, they have so much of those, you know, so many bales that even they are getting choosier about what they want.
Yes, exactly. And this was a learning moment for me, was that the kind of the middle piece of that was the, what were they called? Textile recyclers and rag graders. So what the thrift store can't sell, and in a thrift store, this is why you have to go to the thrift store so often, because they have to cycle their stuff through pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And Klein says that they have to sell it within 3 to 5 weeks, where it goes to this rag out where they compress it into the cubes. And so just to give the amount on that, the Salvation Army Center that she visited did 36 bales or 18 tons every 3 days. So that's what the thrift store is not going to sell. So then the textile recyclers and rag graders get it, and they separate it again, and they had, I think they said like 200 different categories to, you know, decide what they would keep or turn into rags, and by luck they'll find quality items. So they might find a vintage piece in there, and they said that's kind of their salvation. That's how they'll make their money.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, and so they buy this, and then they have to find markets around the world to sell these, the next stage of the bale. And like you said, Melissa, that, you know, when it goes to Africa, they have access to cheap goods, and they get so many of these bales of clothing that the items are quite shoddy, and they don't want them either.
Mm-hmm.
And so the only other place that this stuff can go is in the landfill.
I think I remember her saying, by one estimate, used clothing is now the U.S. number one export by volume.
Oh, yes.
Is that amazing?
Yes. Again, that's kind of a sad reflection, I think, of just how much accumulates.
Mm-hmm.
And then what do you do with it?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if, you know, we've traveled internationally, so it's kind of interesting to go to other countries and see what they're wearing. And sometimes it is what we used to wear. And I don't know, it sort of brings about this realization, oh, maybe we sent this to you when we didn't want it anymore. It's very sad.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it is kind of funny to see some of the name brand things or you know, store brand things and or team names and that kind of thing on children in other countries.
Right. But the effect that all of this is having on the environment is pretty darn scary.
And again, I don't think many people think about that.
Exactly.
So Klein says that, you know, of course we throw away things and you know, worn out underwear, socks that have holes in them. And then there's things that are usable textiles and clothing that we also throw away. So we throw away 12.7 million tons or 68 pounds of textiles per person per year. And they estimate, the EPA estimates that 1.6 million tons of this could be recycled or reused. It's just mind-boggling.
Mm-hmm.
But you were telling us a story about some socks that you have.
I have wool socks that my mother made on her knitting machine. And they must have been made at least 40 years ago, probably at least 45 years ago. I still wear them. And that, they're perfectly good. They have not worn out.
And that tells you something about quality, the difference between quality. And I think that some people might make the argument, who'd want to wear the same thing for 40 years?
Oh, well,
some
thanks,
years.
I
not
wash
me.
I
not
wash
me.
Them.
Yeah, thank God. But go ahead.
Along those same lines, I have a coat that I purchased in 1976. I don't wear it too often in public, but it's what I wear when I go cross-country skiing. It's perfectly good.
Mm-hmm.
And speaking of socks, I like this. Well, I don't like it. It's scary. But she pointed out that if every man, woman, and child in China bought two pairs of wool socks, there would not be any wool left in the world.
Yeah.
The scarcity of resources.
Exactly. And when they talk about the rise of the middle class in China, that's there's a lot of concern for that, because they want the same things that American consumers have. And so
I'm going to keep wearing my 40-year-old wool socks.
Absolutely.
Not buy anymore. No.
And there's this, just because we're kind of on this topic, there's almost like this magic, because some stuff will be old, you know, or outdated or whatever, but then there's vintage. So, you know, I don't know if you have this attitude at all. Well, if I just hold on to it long enough, it'll come back in style, which I think is true, really, for so many things. I remember, you know, we wore flared pants and then they came back.
Mm-hmm.
So bell bottoms, we called them. I have burned my children with my clothing from the 70s. I didn't think I had it, and I lived in a house for 25 years, and apparently number of things were packed in boxes down in the crawl space. And so when I moved out of that home, up came this box with all of my, like, high school clothes and clothing that I had from the early 80s. And so I was like, this is, you know, this is really awesome stuff.
Treasures.
Yes. And of course, that's not my size anymore. And I have passed it on to my children, and with the expectation that they would be gleeful and wearing it on a regular basis. I can't say that I've seen that.
It depends on the item, I will say, because I'm not going to wear a bowling shirt on any given day of the week. And I'm not really sure why you did either.
It was cool.
It was in style.
Now my grandsons are using some of the things for costumes, like my really awesome polyester butterfly collar shirt with the leopard heads on it. You just can't buy that stuff anymore.
That's not something any of the stores are just copying designs of, and everyone has. So it is definitely unique.
It's a one of a kind. Mm-hmm. Yes. Okay. But I think, you know, if you look at how those items are made, they're probably made in the United States, and they're made very well. So I think that, you know, passing those on does say something about, you know, holding on to some quality pieces. Mm-hmm. You'll be passing them on to your great-grandchildren.
Right. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, there is a benefit of sometimes of using some of your valuable storage space to save clothes. I recently realized that I had put on some pounds and some jeans were not fitting the way I wanted them to. Dug down, found some larger sizes that I had set aside. So.
Saved you a trip to the thrift store.
That's right.
Right. So I guess one of the things when you read something like this and you become more aware of just what's going on, and, you know, we've talked about, you know, the price to laborers in other countries, but even in the United States, you know, we do have some sweatshops and we do have some, you know, unethical practices in our own country. So, you know, trying to be aware of that and where does our clothing come from and how much are the laborers being paid? And then the materials, where do the materials come from and are they ethically produced? And then thinking about how much do we need? You know, this idea of, you know, I'm going to go out and buy this item. Do I need it? And I guess the answer to that so often would be no, huh? Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, it's not that we necessarily need everything that we get, but.
And think about how many clothes most of us have. Way more than we need, and we actually wear a very small percentage of them.
And she talked about that. I think she said that she thought she wore, 15% of hers, but somebody else had identified that they wore 4% mm-hmm. of theirs. So a very small focused mm-hmm. number. So I guess, I think, you know, part of the lesson in it then is just being more mindful of that, you know, having some conscious awareness of where your products come from. Why are you purchasing it in the first place? You know, it might be just, you know, shopping is enjoyable. It's nice to have new things.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then the other lesson I think she gives us is the idea of repair, refashion, and reuse. And, you know, the thrift stores talked about the items that would come in and would be unsaleable because they have broken zippers or missing buttons and that kind of thing. And so, again, with our kind of throwaway society, thinking we're not going to sew a button on, which is easy.
Even though we don't sew, we could still do that.
Yes. Yes.
I do sew buttons on.
Yes. So one website I visited, and I don't know if either one of you did, was The Refashionista. And she was written up on BuzzFeed. She's been on some other news stories, but she takes thrift store finds and turns them into fashionable items. So she had some wonderful pictures of some just ugly, large pieces of clothing, usually dresses, and then she would take them and refashion them, and she's a young woman in her 20s, I think, into darling, really cool, hip, modern-looking pieces, and, you know, and then she takes them to thrift stores and lets them resell them, or to consignment shops or charitable events to resale. Did you look at that one? You did not?
No.
Okay. But again, I think if somebody has some talent in that area, I mean, that's certainly a boon, too, because there's a lot of things that are going to not sell in thrift stores and could be used in that fashion.
Right. And she pointed out how, you know, we should talk so much about the fast fashion, but she also commented towards the end of the book that that there is hope. There's a slow fashion. I forget, that's not exactly what she called it. Just like people are making an effort to shop locally for their food, slow food becoming a trend.
The localism.
Mm-hmm,
yeah.
Slow fashion, sewing your own clothes, refashioning, like you were talking about, mm-hmm. is becoming more popular.
And even in terms of the internet, younger people will use that as an outlet to shop for essentially anything. But whereas in the past we may have gone more onto the online version of these more popular box stores, now you can go onto websites like Etsy or even like ModCloth and find people that are making one-of-a-kind designs and that are produced in the U.S.
And I just did a Google search of clothing made in the U.S. and a huge list came up. And so I went on to some of those sites, very unique pieces, and I think more transparent in their clothing too, because they would talk made in the USA, imported fabric. And so I think they give you more information on their specifications than you might otherwise get. And so there's some, you know, truth in advertising in that then. She also talked about, I'm glad you guys brought up like the localism and made, you know, close by. But she talked about some of the manufacturers that are actually moving their operations back to the U.S. from China.
Right.
And I think there might be more of a voice of people saying, you know, I don't want, you know, we're more aware now of the sweatshop and labor conditions in those countries. We're aware that people aren't being treated fairly. We are aware that the environment is being impacted by this. And so we want, you know, clothing made ethically and close by. And I think maybe manufacturers and designers are hearing that.
That's a good thing.
And I think the other thing is that's a little bit of a paradigm shift then is what are we willing to pay for quality clothing? And if people get if we go back, you know, it's not a new idea. It's, you know, going back to how we used to think about clothing, that it was an investment. It was something that you spent some time thinking about and valued, like you said earlier, Lauren. And so, you know, are we willing to go back to that kind of thinking?
I think so. I think, if we take all of that into account, we should be willing to pay a higher price for a piece of clothing, knowing that the value will be greater of that clothing because it's ethically made, it's had a low impact on the environment, whatever it may be. I think that that's just sort of common sense.
Mm-hmm. I think as people become more and more educated about these issues and realize that they get often a greater sense of satisfaction, you know, than just sort of this giving in to the instant gratification you might get from buying something cheap. It is becoming more popular, just this awareness of buying local, buying the best quality that you can for your money.
Well, I hope so. Hopefully we've inspired a few people out there to think a little bit more about this. So I want to thank Melissa and Lauren for joining me today as we talked about Overdressed by Elizabeth Klein.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
March is National Women's History Month, and we will be discussing America's Women, 400 Years of Dolls, Drudges, Helpmates, and Heroines by Gail Collins. The history of American women is about the fight for freedom, Collins writes in her introduction, but it's less a war against oppressive men than a struggle to straighten out the perpetually mixed message about women's roles that was accepted by almost everybody of both genders. Joining me will be Dana Stabenow and Deborah Gadosh. I also want to remind listeners that 89.5 is a community radio station that relies on support from listeners like you, so please take the time to visit our website, radiofreepalmer.org, and become a contributing member. This is Judy Getty with Radio Book Club. Happy reading.
The Radio Book Club is supported by the Read Alaska Award Program at Fireside Bookstore in downtown Palmer. Mm-hmm.